I hope you all had a good Easter. It's been 2 weeks since we've had Sunday school together. So let's get started. Let's pray.
I can share.
Lord, thank you for just the beautiful sunshine and a reminder that the spring warmth is coming. And Lord, just open our hearts to your word as we look at it and meditate on your truths today. Lord, give me your servant the words to say. And Lord, may your words reach the hearts of the ladies here. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. I gotta get my glasses. Silly me. Okay. Pretend to be young, but there are times you cannot pretend. Okay. So we start today in Esther 2:19. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time at the king's gate, Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found that to be so, the men were hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set him his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's men who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servant who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. They told, and he would not listen to them. They told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots, before Haman day after day. And they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the province of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who are in charge of the king's business, that they may be put into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jew. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also. Do with them as it seems good to you." Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict according to all that Haman commanded was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces, and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script, and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued in every province by proclamation to all people to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by the order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. I'll leave it open. So if I extended stand. Okay, so this lesson gets into a dark space. Last time we were together, we had beautiful Queen Esther, and wow, things were good, and we are going into a dark place today. When I was about 10 years old, my family lived in a bungalow in Holt, Michigan, with my five other siblings. Very normal for that time. Many families had small houses with lots of children. My bed was in a little gable room off the bigger shared room in the attic. And above the foot of my bed on the panel wall, I taped a paper I had gotten at Sunday school that I would read when I woke up in the morning. It read, "Lord, You are my unseen but ever-present King. I submit myself to you as your loyal subject this day." At night, I would look out of my gabled window at the stars and wonder about my unseen God. As I prepared this lesson, I thought of those nights and early mornings, wondering about my unseen but ever-present God. The world that I lived in most of my life seemed safe, and I sometimes forgot that it is God whom I trust, whom I need to trust, and not in the political wins in Washington or in the money in the bank. Let's review a little bit of what Courtney said about providence 2 weeks ago. Providence, God's work of his most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all his creatures, ordering them and all their actions to his glory. Mm-hmm. The word providence comes from the Latin providio. I suppose video also comes from Latin, which means that a thing that, which means that I see a thing beforehand, that is pro, before, and I video, I see. So the root meaning of providence is foresight. In as much, however, as foresight brings action in relation to what is foreseen, providence has taken on the meaning of activity coming from foresight. There is only one who has true foresight, and he alone, therefore, is able to act on the basis of foreknowledge. Providence, then, in its absolute sense, is the divine foreknowledge and the divine activity that arises from that. And such providence implies that God wills absolute power over all of the works of his hands. It is this which we see demonstrated in the book of Esther. The crisis about which the book is written is providentially anticipated and providentially overruled just at the crucial moment. No miraculous interventions like we saw with Exodus are resorted to. All the happenings are recorded out of the outworking of circumstances in their natural sequence. So, the passage that I just read for you clearly shows that there is danger in the world. But as we start in the reading, it doesn't look like there's danger. My goodness, Esther's the queen. She's the beautiful queen. It's easy to get blindsided into thinking from lesson two, where Courtney had explained God's providence in making a captive a queen. And at the end of chapter 2, where I started reading, and where we begin our lesson 3, God, it seems, has established peace for his people living in Persia. Yay! Yay, God! Oh. Things, yeah. Sorry, that comes from being a children's teacher. Things look pretty good for Queen Esther, Mordecai, and the rest of the Jews that stayed behind when Zerubbabel took the first group of exiles to Jerusalem 50 years prior. They were content to live below the radar in a foreign land. Content to live as non-Jews. We saw in the passage, Queen Esther continues to obey Mordecai. In Esther 2:20, she continues to obey Mordecai in that she doesn't reveal that she is a Jew. They enjoy positions of authority and honor. Things are good. Esther is queen, and Mordecai has an honor position at the gate of the citadel of Susa. as we saw in the study of Ruth, where Boaz in Ruth 4:1 goes to the gate to settle whose kinsman is going to be Ruth's redeemer. The gate of the city is where disputes were settled and official business was transacted. As with Daniel in Daniel 6, they enjoyed the favor of the king. It was a beautiful day in the neighborhood. The virgins were gathered a second time. But they were no threat to Queen Esther, who, as Courtney pointed out 2 weeks ago, has charmed a self-centered king and given a little glimmer of hope that he will not be as self-centered. In Esther 2:16, we saw that Esther was made queen in the seventh year of the reign of Queen Ahasuerus. And then in Esther 3:7, we see that it is now the 12th year of the reign of King Ahasuerus. Esther has continued in these 5 years of marriage to obey her cousin Mordecai, just as when he was raising her. That's in Esther 2:20. But like Mary Poppins, the winds of change are coming. Sorry, I'm a children's teacher. And I got to watch out, laughing with this thing on me. While at the gate, Mordecai hears two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, plot to lay hands on the king. Mordecai was faced with a dilemma. Oh, I'm going to give my age again, because some of you might not know this. Will he be like Colonel Klink from Hogan's Heroes and say, "I know nothing, nothing, nothing"? See, some of you watched Hogan's Heroes. Or will he take a risk in his identity as a Jew being discovered by informing the king of the plot? Mordecai is a faithful servant. The king is saved, and the eunuchs are hung. Now, when we see gallows hanging in this passage, we think of ropes and hanging by the neck. Well, that's not the way the Persians hung their prisoners or hung those that they were punishing. The Persians had a different way of hanging, and that was impaling the person that they were hanging. So the hanging was actually, they were hung on a sharp stick, and their body was put on the top of that sharp stick and dragged down until the sharp part of the stick went through the neck. So now you got a gross picture instead of hanging from.
If you don't have that to worry about, there's another way someone could hurt you.
So, it was a different. Somehow it seems a little bit easier to think about a rope. But this was a usual form of capital punishment for the Persians. Mordecai's name was entered into the Book of Chronicles in the presence of the king. We see in Esther 2:23. So his name is out there. It's in the book. Herodotus tells of King Xerxes, that is King Ahasuerus. He would have his secretaries record each time he saw one of his officers behaving with distinction in the battle with the Greeks. And that's from the New American Commentary. So sometimes it seems like King Ahasuerus doesn't really care about details, but when it comes to bravery and doing good deeds, he's all about that. And he writes down details in his chronicles. I mean, he has his scribes do it. Mordecai received no reward for his faithfulness. What is this? I mean, God is providentially taking care of his people, but Mordecai is not noticed. He just has his name written in a book. Remember Joseph waiting in a forgotten jail cell for 2 whole years after the cupbearer went up and was restored to his position with the Pharaoh? 2 full years. But God's providential timing is always spot on, right? Later in Esther, not now, not in this chapter, but later in Esther, we will again see that God's timing for Mordecai and this event will be perfect. God will bring this oversight to the attention of the king, but now he is called to be faithful to his God in the place that God has placed him. God also calls each of us to be faithful in our present circumstance, because he is present and he is always faithful. As another instead of Mordecai is surprisingly promoted, as we read on in the chapter, Mordecai's identity now is going to be fully exposed. He was just written down in the book of the king, and now he's going to be fully exposed. His name in the king's book, it seemed like, was forgotten, and perhaps Mordecai was glad about that because he could sink below the radar again and enjoy again his life of safety. But this safety is about to be shaken to its lying core. There is no safety in this world. Haman, the antagonist of this story, is ready for an introduction. See, Courtney got the protagonist, beautiful Queen Esther, and I get Haman, the antagonist, introduced as an Agagite by the narrator of Esther in Esther 3:1. It seems likely that he was a descendant of King Agag. Agag was a title for the Amalekites. So it seems unusual that Agagite would be used in the description. But Haman probably came from a territory called Agag that was adjacent to Media. And this is from the International Bible Encyclopedia. And that area adjacent to Media was settled by a lot of Amalekites. Jeff also pointed out that the name Haman sounds like the Hebrew word for rage. By the way, I want to put a plug in for Wednesday evenings. If you have time on Wednesday evenings to come and do a deeper study, you don't have to be a teacher and stand up here, but it is a teacher training. And it is a wonderful study that we have on Wednesday where we together go deep into God's Word. But Jeff pointed out that Haman sounds like the Hebrew word for rage. And that's in Esther 1:12 and Esther 3:5, we see rage, that word, being used, that Hebrew word being used. It is a Persian name, however. Haman had a Persian name, and his Persian name means magnificent. What a better name for the antagonist of the story. That's from Easton Bible Dictionary. How magnificent. I'm sure that Haman felt magnificent as he went through the gates and everyone bowed and paid homage as the king had commanded. But if he was truly magnificent, would there be a need for a king's command to bow down? Wouldn't the bowing come naturally? One man in the crowd was noticed by the king's servants as standing in the crowd. Notice that Haman is not the one that first sees that Mordecai is standing. It is the king's servants that first see it. And Mordecai, the one who wanted to live happily below the radar and told Queen Esther, do not reveal your heritage as a Jew, was standing, as the Chinese would say, like a tall tree attracting the wind. Like Joseph was tempted day after day by Potiphar's wife in Genesis 39:10, the king's officers spoke to Mordecai day after day, trying to reason with him to get him to bow down. But he would not listen. Esther 3:4. We are not told exactly why he didn't bow. When I was reading on it, it was there were really only two reasons for not bowing, but there wasn't a conclusion on either one. Either Haman, in some way, presented himself as a god, and we know with Daniel's three friends, they would not bow to the image. They stood up when everyone else bowed. And that example comes to mind when we see Mordecai standing while everyone else is bowing to Haman. The other reason would be because Mordecai knew, like the narrator of the story knew, that Haman was an Amalekite, an enemy of the Jews. Either way, he could not bow. And the reason that he gave for not bowing was that he was a Jew. His cover was now blown. He was no longer hiding behind his Babylonian name of Mordecai. Mordecai was fully exposed now as a Jew, as one of God's people. Mordecai had not followed the example of his ancestor, Saul, in disobedience. I'm sure, like in my family, that the family stories were told over and over again, and I'm sure that Mordecai, as he was growing up, heard the story of his ancestor Saul and the kingdom being taken away from him because of his disobedience. He now had his turn, and he chose to stand with God and God's people. People are often forced into confrontations they would rather not have. Without a doubt, Mordecai would have preferred to avoid Haman altogether and live below the radar. Circumstances made this impossible. Haman was in an elevated position, placed there by King Ahasuerus himself, and Mordecai's bold refusal to bow placed him in the crosshairs of retaliation. He didn't ask for this fight, but God is preparing his heroes, as A.B. Simpson said, who's the founder of the Christian Missionary Alliance. God is preparing his heroes, and when the opportunity comes, he fits them into their places in a moment, and the world wonders, where did they come from? Now the king's officers would find out if Mordecai's words would stand before Haman. That's in Esther 3:4. So Haman is standing. Will his words stand before Haman? Is his excuse good enough? Now in the next section, Haman, the antagonist, is fully identified as the enemy of the Jews in Esther 3:10. When he saw that Haman would not bow or pay homage to him, he was in full rage, like his name in Hebrew sounds like. He didn't want just to get Mordecai. He wanted the extermination of all of the Jews. A 500-year-old battle is about to be replayed. An ancestor of King Agag against the ancestor of King Saul. As Warren Wiersbe states, Mordecai wasn't nurturing a personal grudge against Haman so much as enlisting in a perpetual battle God has for those who work, has with those who work for the devil and try to hinder his will in this world. A battle that has set in motion, that was set in motion in the Garden of Eden when man sinned and God promised a rescuer. That rescuer is Jesus. And throughout history, Satan has tried and always failed to stop God's plan. To understand, I'm going to have to skip some of this here. You know, I worried that I don't have enough, and then I. to understand this, we need to go back in history. The Amalekites were attacking God's people. The Amalekites that were descendants from Esau were attacking God's people. And God told Saul, were attacking God's people when they were going into the promised land. And when Saul became king, he was told to destroy them all. And then Samuel comes and finds that Saul has not obeyed. And we hear the line that we're familiar with, to obey is better than sacrifice, because Saul said, well, you know, I saved King Agag and I saved a few of the animals for sacrifice. To obey is better than sacrifice. I'm sure it was a family story that he knew well, and he was not going to make And Mordecai was not going to make the same mistake. So Haman threatened the survival of God's people and God's plan. And he cast lots. And I will go quickly over that part and move on. He was casting lots, and it was interesting that he started casting them in the first month. And as I read it, the first time I read it, I thought he was casting all year long. And then I realized what he and his astrologers were doing was casting lots on a calendar. And they were trying to find the right day. And the lot fell on the 12th month of Adar. And they're in the first month. So that was the best day. The best day for him to exterminate the Jews. But God controls the toss of the lots. It was not Haman. And the first month of the year was also when the Jews had in mind the Passover and their deliverance from Egypt. So as Haman goes into the king and wheels and deals, I'll give you 10,000 talents of silver to get this deed done. God has his plan, and his plan is the survival of his people. Because Jesus was going to come through his people. Now the king said, oh, you know, the silver, you could do what you want, but the money is given to you. And we look at that and we think, well, the king paid, and Haman didn't even pay the 10,000 talents, but that is typical Eastern culture fashion of refusing a gift, but really taking it. And I've seen that played over and over again when we take gifts to China, and they say no, and we give it to them anyways because that is what you do. So the king agreed to Haman's plan, and he wasn't bothered with the details. He was the king, and these small matters were for his officers. So he gave Haman authority. And again, we see Haman with the king's signet ring and making an edict, another edict. We've seen so many edicts. And this edict goes out like in the first chapter to all the provinces of Persia. And as we saw in the first chapter, they could get to all the parts of the kingdom in 15 days with their best horses. So they carried this edict around, and Ahasuerus and King Ahasuerus and Haman sat down to drink, just like Nero. They didn't care that they had thrown the city into confusion. It looks hopeless for God's people. It does look hopeless. But they remember God's deliverance from Egypt. The rescuer would come again to rescue them. The edict was sent out the night before they sat down to their Seder dinner of remembrance. And that, I'm sure, was on their mind. Jesus tells his disciples in John 16:33, "In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. If the world hates you, remember it hated Jesus before it hated us." John 15:18. Only what is found in Jesus is eternal. And he is present in our present. And though he is unseen, he is acting on behalf of his people for his glory. Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm over time. And